You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is once again the artist Richard Kraft, a guest on a previous All Things Cage program with his wife, Lisa Pearson, publisher-in-chief of Siglio Press, who put out the first ever complete edition of John Cage's diary, How to Improve the World, You Will Only Make Matters Worse, in 2015. This was a stellar reenactment by Richard Kraft and co-editor Joe Beal of Cage's process of layout of his 8-part public diary into varying chance-determined fonts and colors. This was a process only realized by Cage once with regard to his diary, Part 3, published as a Great Bear pamphlet in 1967, by Dick Higgins and Something Else Press. Tonight's program is on the subject of Richard Kraft's new book, It Is What It Is, All the Cards Issued to Donald Trump, January 2017 to January 2021, published by Siglio Press in 2020. Rather than introduce this beautiful and important work through what have become traditional means on this program, let me read Leah Ullman's excellent review, which appeared on the Brooklyn Rail in its December 21 to January 22 issue. In the introduction to his astonishing 1,600-page, 5-volume set fusing private protest and public record, Richard Kraft invokes photographer Robert Adams, who advises reckoning with terror head-on through visual form. Go to the landscape that frightens you most and take pictures until you're not scared anymore. Kraft has used a camera for previous work, staged performative interventions of varying scale, and made collages on both paper and film. In fear and outrage on the morning of Donald Trump's inauguration as the 45th U.S. president, he summoned different tools. The rectangular colored penalty cards that soccer referees issue when a player has committed a foul, yellow for a warning, and red for dismissal from the game. On that day in 2017, Kraft, born in London and based in Los Angeles and the Hudson Valley, started assigning such cards for each of Trump's lies and acts of improper conduct on the domestic and global fields. He made a daily practice of reckoning with the unfolding, unnatural disaster, answering the relentless chaos of the Trump years with a methodical conceptual program. Diligently, soberly, he mapped the farce until 10,820 cards later, Trump was at last ejected from office. Books analyzing the Trump administration and tell-all memoirs by those who served within it continue to be released at a steady pace, each one promising a dose of clarity to aid in our collective recovery. Kraft's set belongs among them, and yet apart. His real-time diary is a dazzling testament to its subject's basic incomprehensibility. Each volume of It Is What It Is encompasses 1 year of the former president's tenure, except for the last year, so fat with egregious abuses that it required 2 separate volumes. By the end of Kraft's 4-year exercise in scrupulous attention, an excruciating durational performance, his palette had bloomed to 10 colors. To accommodate the burgeoning range and increasing intensity of Trump's transgressions, the spectrum denoting fouls surged past yellow, false verbal claims, empty threats, backpedaling, and the like, and red, more hostile attacks, more blatant self-dealing, and higher stakes lies, to magenta, purple, and finally crimson when Trump refused to guarantee a peaceful transfer of power. Orange cards were added to signify Trump's golf days and pink to stand for others who joined him on the course. Kraft assigned dark blue cards to represent those fired or resigned from the administration, and lime green for those in Trump's orbit who contracted COVID-19. He issued cards in a quenching teal to mark acts of resistance, such as editorials, public statements, and court testimony speaking truth to power. Every book in the set contains its own color key, followed by double-page spreads of 80 colored blocks in a calendrical grid. A spread might represent one day, four, seven, 11, or more. The sequencing of the cards was determined not by aesthetic intent, but by the order in which Kraft became aware of each breach. Spreads read at once as luminous mosaics and percussive, portentous alerts. Color alone tells the story, a narrative of escalating tension and danger. Less yellow per page, more and more crimson. But Kraft also provides detailed annotations of each card's referent incident and an index that organizes the individual offenses into categories, such as conspiracy theories, media, race, religion, and women. In published form, It Is What It Is has startling assertive mass. Each volume measures a modest 5 by 8 inches, but when stacked or slipcased together, their combined heft registers dauntingly in the body the way the accreted archived injustices and injuries to the democratic system weigh on the mind. Yet the books are beautiful, vibrantly so, insistently so, and this visual splendor exerts an elevating counterforce to the despair elicited by the very same information delivered verbally. Moral depravity is made to coexist with sensual pleasure. Through the project's own inherent contradictions, Kraft fine-tunes the incredulity that suffused the Trump years into a persuasive case for simultaneity. It Is What It Is marries the literal and the abstract, evidence and emblem. Temporally, it operates with both graphic immediacy and as serial progression. It embeds dissonance within a kind of jaunty harmony. Kraft heaps toxic muck into a formal vehicle of exceeding elegance and grace. His stance is both scathing and playful, his aesthetic at once stark and lush. All of this generative friction makes for an engrossing experience. Not just the eye, and not just the intellect, not just the heart, not just the hand, and not just the conscience. All at once are engaged, pressured, and provoked. To create It Is What It Is, Kraft assumed the role of referee, close observer, immersed in the game, calling out fouls. Which is to say, the role of a citizen practicing participatory democracy, author of and authority on his own beliefs. His fury burns both hot and cool. Lined up in order on the shelf, the spines of Kraft's 5 books hit every chromatic note on the designated scale of wrongdoing, even as, together, they embody action, their unifying sheath, the refreshing hue of resistance. Welcome to All Things Cage, Richard. It's a pleasure to have you back. How are you?
I'm very well, Laura. Thank you for inviting me back. It's to be here.
It's really my pleasure. You know, I'm a huge fan, as I've said, of your new book, which is called It Is What It Is. I'm going to ask you to describe it, but I've given it away for Christmas presents to anybody who I think would enjoy it, which is almost everybody I know. This book came out last year, although with the vagaries of the supply chain mess that we had. I take it your book sat on a ship out in the Pacific Ocean for a while.
They sat on the ship in the Pacific Ocean for a while. They took a while to leave Korea. It was a long, circuitous route to the United States, but gladly they arrived in one piece, and we're really happy to have them and for people to have them now.
And in time for Christmas.
And in time for Christmas, a very jovial Christmas present.
I can't think of a nicer Christmas present to give to anybody. It is, we're going to talk about this at more length, but as I've told you, this book is very much a beautiful admixture of both protest and beauty. And I'm not aware of very many artworks that actually do that as well as you've done it. The book, by the way, for the audience is published by Richards partner, Lisa Pearson, who is Siglio Press. Richard is, of course, a co-editor with Joe Beal of John Cage's Diary in its first ever complete edition, which came out from Siglio in 2016?
2015, I think.
15. Yeah. It was one of my favorite books of that year. You would think I would remember it. So for our audience, if you wouldn't mind starting us off, Richard, by just describing the book. What is the book?
So it's, I guess, books, plural. It is what it is. All the cards issued to Donald Trump is a slipcase set of five books. Each book is quite small, I think about 5 by 8 inches. And within those books is all of the colored cards that I issued to Donald Trump and various other people who were important during the time of his presidency, using the colored cards that a soccer referee uses in what I will call a football game. Hopefully people will understand me when I use that word in this context. So I began with yellow and red, which is what a soccer referee uses. And over the course of Trump's presidency, I expanded those colors to reflect the seriousness of his transgressions. And I'll sort of leave it at that now, other than to say that there were various other cards that were given to people other than Trump. For instance, the most important one for me was a teal card, which was given to people for resisting him. And there were many different forms that those acts of resistance took. Oh, and one other thing I would add about the books include the colored cards themselves as little rectangles, little colored rectangles, and each card is annotated with a text in that same color. So the books include both images in the form of the cards and quite an extensive series of text that describes what those cards are for.
And that information, that is to say, the visuals of the cards and the text are separated in the books, are they not?
Correct. At the front of each book, so there are 5 volumes. The first three are for 2017, 18, and 19, and the last two are for 2020, because 2020 was so off the rails. So one volume of 2020 is just the cards, and the other volume is the annotation for those cards.
You know, Richard, it strikes me, and it didn't strike me when I was just looking at the book, but hearing you talk, I'm wondering if there was a kind of playful congruence in your mind with using the changing colored texts, or not using it, but that it happened very much with Cage's Diary when you made.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No, without a doubt, it was very much on my mind. I love the way it worked in Diary and looks in Diary. And yeah, it was very much on my mind as.
Right. And it's not something you duplicated. It's something that happened naturally out of the shape that the book, I'm not even sure how to say it, but the way that you came to do the book, which is through the referee cards and the colored cards, that it was a natural extension of that to use the color.
Right. So it had a practical use, which is if you see a yellow text, it means that that card was yellow and so on and so forth. So, but I definitely, Diary was certainly in the back of my mind, as Cage was for much of the time that I worked on this piece and the way that it began, actually.
Right. So you started with the two colors, which are the direct lift from the soccer referee.
Right.
How long did that sustain itself before you added color?
About 5 minutes, actually. So that I added the next color, which was magenta, on the first day of Donald Trump's presidency, when he immediately began to revoke certain rights with regard to LGBTQ people. And, you know, that felt like a very aggressive move very quickly in his presidency. So that was the first magenta. But then I didn't add another color until COVID, actually, at least for him specifically. I did give orange cards for every time he played golf, because he was so critical of President Obama for playing golf while he was president. And then I decided that the people who played golf with him should get a card just because they were playing golf with him. So they got pink. And then when COVID hit, I added purple for Trump. Actually, when he, on that infamous day when he suggested injecting bleach into the body as a potential cure. So that was the next one. And then the final color for him was crimson when he refused to promise that there would be a peaceful transfer of power were he to lose the election. And of course, we all know how that transpired.
So it was yellow as a kind of warning.
Yes.
And red as a kind of transgression, as a black mark or a red mark in that case.
Yeah. So yellow in a football game is a warning and red is you're ejected from the game. Yellow, I awarded yellows for what I felt to be things that many politicians do, that we politicians, for instance, frequently tell fibs, maybe lies, depending on one's perspective. Trump told many thousands of those, but some of them were more in keeping with what a typical politician would do. So those were the kind of things that I gave yellow cards to. You know, in the sphere of his presidency, I suppose might be considered relatively minor infractions, but the number of them actually, I think, is really quite striking.
In soccer, yeah. Richard, isn't it the case that if you get enough yellows, they turn into a red?
Two, right. So the, you get the warning, you get one yellow, then you get another yellow and you're off.
I see. Yeah. That we couldn't extend those rules.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have said that were his Trump's presidency actually a soccer game, he would have been banned for certainly this lifetime. And were there others to come for those as well?
Right. I was flooded with memories looking at this book and actually reading your introduction, which is so beautifully balanced between the facts of your process and the facts of that administration, and with your own personal sort of reflection on what was going on in the world and what you were feeling about what was going on and how to respond as a civic-minded person. I remember when he was inaugurated, or when he won, even long before the inauguration, being horrified, really thinking I felt compelled to go into therapy because I was so fundamentally depressed all the time. I saw what I felt to be writing on the wall, felt so sad all the time, this lingering sadness on behalf of all of my friends of color, all of my gay friends, myself, artists, women, you know, everybody around me. I just felt so sad. But the, remember the immigrants being the most pressing for me because they were the whole situation of fear, of people living in fear of being rounded up and sent back to spaces that they had left for reasons other than just choice, that they couldn't go back. I found the whole thing so horrifying. So I was very taken with some of your comments, which move in the direction of, well, I've said this to you, but let's flesh it out a little bit. I told you that John Cage, and you know this yourself very well from your own experience with Cage, that Cage believed in the transformative power of art. He believed in that very much. And I'm sorry, but a Jasper John quote just flitted through my head. Uh-huh. And it is a quote that Cage himself used for one of his lengthy misostics on Jasper's writings. And the quote is, art is either a complaint or do something else.
Right. It's a great one.
That is very much what you did. How immediate for you was that when you were dashing about in your head, if nowhere else, about how to deal with the emotional turmoil of a Donald Trump being elected by this country? I mean, I contemplated moving to New Zealand.
Yes, yeah, it's a great question. Well, as I say in the introduction, we, Lisa and I were in London on the night of, and the day of the election. And we, like you, were horrified and depressed and really sad that this was the situation. And we were fortunate that the Frith Street Gallery in London had installed during that the end of that year Cage's lecture on the weather. So the morning after the election, we went to see that piece. And it was an extraordinary thing to see. We went in one frame of mind, and we came out not completely in another frame of mind, but from, I suppose, feeling despondent, a sense of a lack of possibility. I left Lecture on the Weather feeling that there are possibilities. And one of those possibilities was to do something with this time, to find a way to both record what I knew would be a really egregious abuse of the power of the presidency. I mean, that was clear that that would be the case, but also to see whether through making a work of art, I couldn't somehow transform it into something, for want of a better word, beautiful. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so that's really where the idea to make this piece began.
Another quote that just came to mind as you were talking is that Cage used to say, if you come upon something that you think you don't like, don't criticize it, make something in response.
Right.
It's a beautiful quote because it really speaks to a call for creative action as opposed to critical action, you know, which is very much the sort of European model of anarchy versus the American model of anarchy. You know, anarchy in America is about self-responsibility. It's Thoreau. It's, you know, it's being responsible for your own actions and doing the right things. And in Europe, it was for a long time throwing Molotov cocktails, burning buildings. Like,
right. Yeah.
I would argue it's still like that.
It still is on May the 1st in some parts of Europe, Germany, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. So that Cage's work, not to lean on that too much, but Cage's work in that really pretty quickly for you, experientially gave you hope. It gave you a sense of purpose as an artist. It gave you a glimmer of the idea that there would be something for you to do.
Yes. And what was particularly striking about Lecture on the Weather in relation specifically to Donald Trump is that Trump, to me, represented or represents a complete failure of the imagination. It's a rejection of curiosity and questioning. And Cage, of course, and Lecture on the Weather is the antithesis of all of that. It's an embrace of questions. It's an embrace of curiosity. It's an embrace of the imagination. It's an embrace of what we don't know.
Right. Actually. It's actually a call for it. It demands it. It says we cannot go on without it. That's a very, very, I was going to say it's the purview of the artist. That's probably totally unfair. There are many people who are not artists who have this quality, but I just think of it very much as kind of rooted in a kind of Cagean aesthetic that, you know, that, well, you get my point. I don't need to labor that one. Anyway, so you became in this, in your, how long did it take you to know what to do? How long after?
Very quickly. I had an experience a number of years ago, rather an unpleasant experience with a gallery that I had worked with. And as a really sort of playful response to that, I drew a yellow and a red card and I mounted them on pieces of paper. And I've, you know, as a silent rebuke to the person that I'd had this experience with, and I've carried it around with me ever since. Every time I move studios, I put it up and it makes me smile. It was something that has become a little talisman, I suppose. So I'd always wanted to do something with this notion of using the yellow and red cards of a soccer referee. So quite quickly, and Trump was an obvious choice.
Right. And that emanates from your childhood. I mean, you grew up in a soccer obsessed family. Your father took you to games weekly. So you knew very much about the role of the referee, the inadequacy of the referee, the command of the referee, the documentation through the referee's behavior, all of the subtleties of what that means to issue a color, issue something.
Yes. And I particularly have been drawn to the way that each referee wields these cards in different ways. You know, there are some who are extremely officious in the way that they raise it and show it to a player. And then some of them, it's a much more casual gesture. There is a performative quality to it that I think is, it's a small part of the game, but it's quite an interesting thing. And so there was something very humorous to me about the notion of me wielding these cards in vast numbers. I mean, I think over the course of the 4 years, there are over 10,000 to somebody who would have no idea that he was receiving these cards. So it was quite a quick decision to use it. And I also loved the notion of how these colors would accumulate over the course of time in a way that I was not specifically determining. They, you know, I chose when to award particular cards, but it was Trump's actions that produced the cards. So,
oh yeah, Richard, be very clear that part of the charm of it for me is the chance operations of it all.
Right. Yes. Yeah. For me too.
Yes. Yeah. That so I can see personally as an artistic sort, I can see the playful joy of carrying out this project. I can also see the satisfaction, even if it's futile or it doesn't go further or it had no immediate effect. It was documentary of behavior, yes, which is very, very important. So we were helpless in the moment, but you were doing something which was capturing all of that, which made me, by the way, when I found that you did this, feel better.
Oh,
for
good.
Some strange reason, you know? It's
like, yeah. Yeah.
Donald Trump could care less about your cards, you know.
Right. But and it made me feel better to do it. You know, in fact, I would say that making this piece was the means by which I was able to pay attention. You know, I could not have paid attention, certainly with the kind of closeness that I did, had I not had this work to focus that attention and to make me feel like it was going into something that would amount to something,
right?
You know, at the end.
In the end, at the very least, it would document the transgressions of a very bad person.
Exactly. And at the end, I would get to see what all of these colors look like. I was constantly thinking, how is this going to look? You know, what will Donald Trump's presidency look like?
It reminds me of when I was in graduate school, I was in a program called systematic musicology, which was really very different than historical musicology, which is what most people think of as musicology. And one of the beautiful things about systematic music, well, one, the main thing about systematic musicology was that you were learning how to look at musical phenomena of all kinds, notation, performance, behavior, biography, any of it, from every possible window. You were trying to look, you know, at it from all these various windows, which was very, very attractive to me. But it also allowed me, in the course of otherwise rigorous academic training, to devise new ways of documenting things, new ways of exploring things. And one of the things that I did was I did analyses of orchestral works by composers over historical periods using color. So the oboe got oboe's got a color, string quartets got a color, you know, string players, whatever, percussion entered the picture at a certain point and those got color. So I had amassed all of these orchestral scores that were nothing more than the identical length of the score, but all done in color.
Not wow, they sound amazing.
It was amazing. It was incredibly fun. It provided me, which is why they let me do it. It provided me with a way of analyzing orchestral scores using some other part of my brain, you know, that wasn't this, you know, note by note kind of nonsense or this structural, not nonsense is unfair. But this this linear, a very linear sort of way that I could look at a page of a score and tell you, oh, it's surely a romantic score, surely. You
know? Right.
Well, wow. This is definitely a 20th century score because you see the pointillistic or you see the atonality of the use of instruments or, you know what I mean?
So I do.
Yes. And it was fun.
Do you still have them? I'd love to see them.
Oh, if they do, they're in a box somewhere. You know, my mother probably kept them and she's long gone. So I could teach you how to do it. You could do it. But it's kind of the same thing, you know, where you're taking this kind of, in your case, just like those scores, a kind of objective information. You weren't voting. You were assigning a transgression card for a lie, for something which was bad behavior that we would all agree upon in a sane world. We would all agree upon. It's hard to talk about this that way, but you were taking objective information and transforming it into color. So it gave you something in the end. I can imagine your great anticipation of looking at this body of cards, which, by the way, for our listening audience who haven't seen it yet, it's incredibly beautiful. It's very,
thank you.
It's incredibly beautiful. At the same time, documenting aberrant bad behavior. And probably the more beautiful it gets, the more aberrant the behavior in a weird way.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, certainly the duality, that duality is really important to me, because I want my work in general to feel like the world. And the world is both extraordinary and terrible at, you know, often at the same time. And so that the duality that you just mentioned is really very, to me, certainly a very important part of that, of this piece. And if I can just go back for a second to what you were saying about the music, I would love for somebody to take this and play it, you know, and sort of make it into a piece of music, which perhaps could be done, maybe not, but
that's a very interesting idea. If you used a very simple process that I used, which was to assign the different bodies of instruments to color. Mm. I didn't sit there and think, oh, what would a cello be? I think it might be this. You know, it really was just sort of, some instruments are a little higher pitched. Some things are a little more raucous. Percussion is rougher. So that kind of thing. But it didn't really matter. It had to do with density, rapidity of changes, juxtapositions. Not sure that's the same situation that one would experience with your cards.
I would just give the drawing to somebody and say, can you play it? You know, what would you do with all of these little colored rectangles?
Right. Because they do change. I mean, so let's go back to the colors for a second. So you start with yellow and red, and then crimson got added pretty quickly.
Magenta.
Oh, sorry, magenta. That's right. Crimson came much later. Yeah. Magenta was quicker. Teal entered the picture after. Well, let's not do that in order, because nobody's going to remember this or care.
Right.
I'm just curious. So the addition of colors went all the way through. What's the last color? And at what point did that get added in the four-year documentation?
I think the last color is a lime green, which it's either lime green or crimson. I think lime green for all of the cases of COVID within Trump's
circle. Within the administration. That's right.
Yes. And simply because of his complete, you know, because he was just flouting the rules of his own administration, which is why those cases were happening. So, but what happens with the progression of colors throughout the books is really quite fascinating, because it starts with a lot of yellow and red and a little bit of magenta. And then there's some orange and pink and teal. And gradually over the course of the books, the colors get darker. There's more red, there's more magenta, then red and magenta become replaced by purple and then crimson. And so by the time we get to this time a year ago, to the end of December, the beginning of January, we've got a lot of crimson, and that really sort of ran through pretty much to the end, you know, certainly through January the 6th. And then after that, it sort of calmed down a little bit. But they are like sort of heat maps in a way, in terms of the way that the colors progress over time.
Sure. Let's go back to something that I've been wanting to ask you. I don't get the opportunity to ask too many people. And you know that I worked with Cage, and I said this in the beginning, that Cage himself, when I have memories of his experiencing sorrow, or what I would call sorrow, usually had to do with his experience of other artists not believing or taking seriously the transformative power of art, that they didn't believe it and they didn't therefore behave like it would. And you yourself, in your introduction, sort of waffle on this point. You talk about, you realize it was an act of futility as you were doing it. On the other hand, you talk about how important it was, the transformative power of doing something positive or moving in the direction of beauty with something which is inherently not beautiful or whatever. Was it mitigated through the process? What happened in the process of doing the work with that duality in you?
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you say that about Cage. And I wonder if really it's a semantic thing, because for me, I'm not quite sure exactly how to put this. I think we suffer from a dearth of uselessness, perhaps. You know, for instance, to take something that was clearly very important to Cage, simply listening, to go outside and listen to the sound of whatever is out there, does not have a sort of what the world would define as a practical use. So it might be dismissed as a sort of useless activity, but for me, it's a completely vital activity. It's one for which we are alive, actually, for such things. And so I, in describing the process of making this work as futile, I did not expect it to change America. You know, I did not expect it to change Donald Trump's behavior. I did not expect it to have an impact on the outcome of the election, or the previous one or the next one. But I certainly hope that it might open the door, and you've described this for me, which is really lovely, to a kind of reverie, you know, to somebody looking at these books and getting lost on one hand in their physical beauty, but also in ruminating on what these cards actually represent, this duality that we spoke about earlier. So for me, I certainly understand Cage's sadness at his sometimes sense that the work might not change the world. Maybe I'm just too jaded. I hate to say it. You know, I'm perhaps more cynical.
You said earlier, though, something which I think maybe even answers my question. I may be mucking about with the thought in the mud a little bit. I think that the usefulness, if you will, of what you were doing had to do with you. You know, what Cage, right. Cage was often talking about, he put the musical experience in three groups. There was the composer, there was the performer, and there was the listener. And that he believed that if he did his work right, it would be useful to all three of those people, but in very different ways, you know, that they would all experience it in other different things would happen. For Cage, it had to do with changing his mind. So Chance Operations, the primary thing was to show him ways of doing something that he had not thought of. It, you know, it was really very simple to give the process over to Chance. People think that was laziness, or, you know, his detractors would say, you know, mm-hmm. it was cheating, or, you know.
Right, right.
So you've already said that very clearly, that for you, it was a way to pull you out of the quagmire of hopelessness, right, after this horrendously terrible thing happened, which is to say Donald Trump getting elected president in a country that maybe not your native country, but one that had become native to you, and certainly was my country. I felt mournful for the United States. I felt mournful. Yes. For the first yeah. time in my life, I remember feeling despair over not only the future of the country, but the whole fabric of the country, you know, that this was not what I loved. I felt horror. I just felt horror at the fact that it wasn't that Donald Trump had become president. I'm a grown woman. I've been around for a long time. I've known schmucks, if you know what I mean, you know, a lot of them. And we don't give them much energy. We just have learned not to give them too much energy. But the mere fact that so many millions of people saw this person and said, oh, yes, let's make him the leader of the free world.
Yeah,
that was the troubling thing. So for me, when you said that, you know, stumbling on Cage in London the day after this happened, being able to be uplifted, to see a way out through Cage's piece, that must have held you in good stead. Like your work, you yourself, Richard's work, could have the same effect, could do the same, maybe under some different circumstance. Maybe by the time it gets out to the world, it's going to be a reflective thing. You know, it's not going to be the thing in the moment that it was for you.
Right.
You were lucky that you hung out with Richard Kraft. You know what I mean? I wish I'd known you then. I would have called you up every day. How many oranges were there today?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It must have, you know, there must have been some playfulness in your heart around the process.
Yeah, well, it was both. You know, it was rough sometimes. I mean, I would be transcribing. I mean, I'm thinking of some of those press conferences that Trump gave right after COVID sort of first hit, and it was brutal. You know, I was transcribing them, giving cards in real time. You know, I'd have CNN or whatever on in the studio, or sometimes just the White House feed. And it was tough. I mean, it was not a fun thing to look at. But as I said earlier, having the work gave me both a reason to do it and a sense of this accumulation of colors that would amount, you know, to what I didn't know what it would actually amount to. But there was that I needed to know what it would amount to. I just want to go back, though, Laura, to something you said earlier about Cage. And it's something I really love about him. And I don't think I have the same feeling, actually, which is he even describes himself as an optimist. I think I recently read the volume that Wesleyan published. It's just called Anarchy, his Misostics on Anarchy. And in that introduction, he says, I am an optimist. I think
the quote I think that maybe is the most pertinent. He said that he was born with a sunny disposition.
Right. So I don't, you know, I admire it. I love it. I just don't think I have it. And I also was struck, and I think a sort of driving factor for me in making this work is, Cage said it very beautifully at the beginning of Empty Words, in his foreword to Empty Words. It's very brief, and I just want to read it, if that's okay. Recently, I was a house guest in Paris. At breakfast, I was talking with another guest in the same home, a lady from Australia. In response to a news report, I said, why? Why did it happen? The lady from Melbourne said, that is a question for which there is no longer an answer. And that seems to be my perpetual state, in a way, you know, in regarding our world at this time.
Right. We're down to about 2 minutes. That's how fast interesting conversation goes. Is there anything that we haven't talked about? The book is absolutely available now. It's off the boats. It's at Siglio, so people can go online to sigliopress.com.
Sigliopress.com. It's also available in bookstores, independent bookstores. So, that's a good place to get it.
Yeah, I highly, highly, highly recommend this book. It really transforms it's both you, Richard, and the work. So I'm really, really happy to say that I feel better having you on this planet at the same time as me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I do. It just made me smile. It just made me feel better knowing that there was somebody that would do something so playful and so creative that you would transform your own experience, which is, you are the only person who can do that to you. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
I do.
Your own experiences, nobody can help you do that, really. So that you were open to being changed, that you let Cage help you, the day after this happened, and you set about, as you said, very quickly to put yourself to work, at least capturing this information and transforming it in your work into something very beautiful, which it isn't at heart. Did you send a copy to Trump?
No, I did not send a copy, although very amusingly, somebody did buy a set and asked for it to be sent to Merrick Garland. So Merrick Garland has a copy somewhere in the Department of Justice.
It's very funny. Well, I want everybody to get this book just because. Just go do it. Thank you so much for your work, Richard.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for having me. It's been really a great pleasure.
Wonderful. We're going to play. I did a show recently all about Lecture on the Weather, but it behooves me to bring back the preface. So I think we're going to append that to this program so people can hear what it was that helped Richard Kraft 24 hours after this horrendous shift in the culture in America and go on to make the book It Is What It Is, which, by the way, is a quote by Donald Trump. When did he say that?
He said that in response to, I forget what milestone it was of COVID deaths, but he was asked about the number of COVID deaths and he just said, it is what it is.
Oh, I see. That
callous disregard is the title of the book.
Lovely. Poor man.
Poor man. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Richard. I can't
okay,
wait
Laura.
To see you again. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Now on to Cage's reading of the preface to The Lecture on the Weather, a work composed in 1975 in collaboration with filmmaker Louis Frangella and composer Marianne Amichet, who produced its weather sounds to be mixed live in performance. Cage's preface, which begins the work, clearly expresses his dismay with the institutions of American government. The work then commences with 12 performers reading text fragments drawn from the writings by Henry David Thoreau. Some also play instruments ad lib, guided by graphic notation derived from snippets of drawings obtained from Thoreau's journals, which in Frangella's film were printed in negative, their projection resembling lightning at night, or white on black. In part one, the readers are accompanied by Amichet's sounds of breeze, in part two by her sounds of rain, and in the third and final part, the lights in the performance space having dimmed to their darkest point, the performers are accompanied by both Frangella's film and Amichet's sounds of thunder. The storm diminishes by the work's close. The performers agree ahead of time on starts and stops of their texts. Lecture on the Weather was composed on a commission from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in observance of the bicentennial of the United States.
The first thing I thought of doing in relation to this work was to find an anthology of American aspirational thought and subject it to chance operations. I thought the resultant complex would help to change our present intellectual climate. I called up Dover and asked whether they published such an anthology. They didn't. I called a part of Columbia University concerned with American history and asked about aspirational thought. They knew nothing about it. I called the information desk of the New York Public Library at 42nd Street. The man who answered said, "You may think I'm not serious, but I am. If you're interested in aspiration, go to the Children's Library on 52nd Street." I did. I found that anthologies for children are written by adults. They're what adults think are good for children. The thickest one was edited by Commager, Documents of American History. It is a collection of legal judgments, presidential reports, congressional speeches. I began to realize that what is called balance between the branches of our government is not balance at all. All the branches of our government are occupied by lawyers. Of all professions, the law is the least concerned with aspiration. It is concerned with precedent, not with discovery, with what was witnessed at one time in one place, and not with vision and intuition. When the law is corrupt, it is corrupt because it concentrates its energy on protecting the rich from the poor. Justice is out of the question. That is why not only aspiration, but intelligence, as in the work of Buckminster Fuller, and conscience, as in the thought of Thoreau, are missing in our leadership. Our leaders are concerned with the energy crisis. They assure us they will find new sources of oil. Not only will Earth's reservoir of fossil fuels soon be exhausted, their continued use continues the ruin of the environment. Our leaders promise they will solve the unemployment problem. They will give everyone a job. It would be more in the spirit of Yankee ingenuity, more American, to find a way to get all the work done that needs to be done without anyone's lifting a finger. Our leaders are concerned with inflation and insufficient cash. Money, however, is credit. And credit is confidence. We have lost confidence in one another. We could regain it tomorrow by simply changing our minds. Therefore, even though the occasion for this piece is the bicentennial of the USA, I have chosen to work again with the writings of Henry David Thoreau. Those excerpts which are used were not selected to stress any particular points, but were obtained by means of E. King chance operations from Walden, from the Journal, and from the Essay on Civil Disobedience. Thoreau lived not 200 years ago, but for 44 years only, beginning 159 years ago. In 1968, I wrote as follows. Reading Thoreau's journal, I discover any idea I've ever had worth its salt. In 1862, Emerson wrote, "No truer American existed than Thoreau. If he brought you yesterday a new proposition, he would bring you today another, not less revolutionary." In 1929, Gandhi wrote that he had found the Essay on Civil Disobedience so convincing and truthful that as a young man in South Africa preparing to devote his life to the liberation of India, he had felt the need to know more of Thoreau and so had studied the other writings. In 1958, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote these words, "As I thought further, I came to see that what we were really doing was withdrawing our cooperation from an evil system, rather than merely withdrawing our economic support from the bus company. The bus company, being an external expression of the system, would naturally suffer, but the basic aim was to refuse to cooperate with evil." At this point, I began to think about Thoreau's Essay on Civil Disobedience. I remembered how, as a college student, I had been moved when I first read this work. I became convinced that what we were preparing to do in Montgomery was related to what Thoreau had expressed. We were simply saying to the white community, we can no longer lend our cooperation to an evil system. On December 8, 1859, Thoreau himself wrote as follows, 200 years ago is about as great an antiquity as we can comprehend or often have to deal with. It is nearly as good as 2,000 to our imaginations. It carries us back to the days of Aborigines and the Pilgrims, beyond the limits of oral testimony, to history which begins already to be enameled with a gloss of fable, and we do not quite believe what we read, to a strange style of writing and spelling and of expression, to those ancestors whose names we do not know and to whom we are related only as we are to the race generally. It is the age of our very oldest houses and cultivated trees, nor is New England very peculiar in this. In England also, a house 200 years old, especially if it be a wooden one, is pointed out as an interesting relic of the past. I have wanted in this work to give another opportunity for us, whether of one nation or another, to examine again, as Thoreau continually did, ourselves, both as individuals and as members of society, and the world in which we live, whether it be concord in Massachusetts or discord in the world, as our nations apparently for their continuance, as though they were children playing games, prefer to have it. It may seem to some that through the use of chance operations, I run counter to the spirit of Thoreau and 76 and revolution for that matter. The fifth paragraph of Walden speaks against blind obedience to a blundering oracle. However, chance operations are not mysterious sources of the right answers. They are a means of locating a single one among a multiplicity of answers, and at the same time of freeing the ego from its taste and memory, its concern for profit and power, of silencing the ego so that the rest of the world has a chance to enter into the ego's own experience, whether that be outside or inside. I have given this work the proportions of my silent piece, which I wrote in 1952, though I was already thinking of it earlier. When I was 12, I wrote a speech called Other People Think, which proposed silence on the part of the USA as preliminary to the solution of its Latin American problems. Even then, our industrialists thought of themselves as the owners of the world, of all of it, not just the part between Mexico and Canada. Now our government thinks of us also as the policemen of the world. No longer rich policemen, just poor ones, but nonetheless on the side of the good and acting as though possessed of the power. The desire for the best and the most effective in connection with the highest profits and the greatest power led to the fall of nations before us. Rome, Britain, Hitler's Germany, those were not chance operations. We would do well to give up the notion that we alone can keep the world in line, that only we can solve its problems. More than anything else, we need communion with everyone. Struggles for power have nothing to do with communion. Communion extends beyond borders. It is with one's enemies also. Thoreau said, "The best communion men have is in silence." Our political structures no longer fit the circumstances of our lives. Outside the bankrupt cities, we live in megalopolis, which has no geographical limits. Wilderness is global park. I dedicate this work to the USA, that it may become just another part of the world. No more, no less.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.